Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Coaching Call podcast. On this podcast, we'll cover various types of coaching by trainers in sports, martial arts, fitness, and business. We'll discuss each coach's methods to getting the most out of their respective athletes or clients and how they attempt to change the platform in which they coach. Join us on a fun adventure as we discuss unique coaching styles. Coaching is a universal part of how we get others to get something done. Join your host, Rafael, and his guests on this unique journey in coaching.
Hi, I'm Sifu Rafael, and this is the Coaching Call podcast. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. This episode was made possible by listeners like you. Steve, thank you so much for joining me on Coaching Call. How are you, my friend?
My pleasure, Rafael. Very, very glad to be here.
Yeah, yeah. We have a lot to talk about, right?
Great deal.
So one of the things that, you know, for me, it's always, and I know you understand this of all people, is how our childhood has truly made us who we are. So I would love to hear about little Steve when he was running around doing things, probably getting in trouble when you were 5, 6, 7 years old. Tell us about that. Where'd you grow up, and who was your biggest influences back then?
Well, I think that's a brilliant question, Rafael. I grew up on Long Island. I think that the most important thing looking back about childhood is that regarding the things that were most important to me, I rarely got them right the first time around. And so what that did was it made me value learning a great deal. The only thing that I ever experienced myself being a natural at was music. But there were so many other things that you'd want to do, social skills, learning skills, academic skills, all of those things I found, like I discovered early on that there was a process for everything I wanted to learn. And so I became truly passionate about learning. And that that really set the tone for everything that I've ever accomplished. Even my natural skill, music, I discovered that the difference between trained me and natural me was so great that I became a great believer in our ability to expand our capabilities. And that really, I think, led to many of the things I was able to accomplish. And I think a great deal of the value that I bring to the young people that I coach.
Very cool. Very cool. So who would you say when you were young was one of the people or a few people that influenced you the most?
Great question again. Well, when I was very young, my heroes were all people who appeared to have natural gifts. I looked at Mozart for music, who was just an extraordinary intelligence. I looked at I looked at inventors like Edison, who seemed to be an extraordinary intelligence. And so I would say, until I was between college and graduate school, I was a believer in natural gifts. In other words, it wasn't as developmental as it might be, because I looked at my heroes were those who were who just appeared to be effortlessly extraordinary. And it was between college and graduate school that I discovered, I want to call it, the elasticity of our capabilities, that we are ultimately what we decide to be and what we create ourselves as. And that was something I discovered in my journeys between college and graduate school.
Very cool.
Would you like to hear that story in terms of how that happened? It was sort of
absolutely
a formative experience, in that it set up my what I want to call my accidental tutoring company, which is the relevant coaching experience we're going to talk about here. So I had a certain arrogance in high school. I believed in natural gifts primarily. I did not believe in hard work. I was one of the people who were one of those people that you see in every high school who are figuring out how I could do the minimum I could do to do passably well. And there was one girl in our high school named Barbara who seemed to have those natural gifts. She never seemed to get a question wrong. So she was our high school's version of Mozart. She just didn't seem to know how to get a question wrong. And so I found myself staying out of the orbit of being an achiever because I felt that no matter how hard I practiced, I would never be as good as Barbara anyway. And so I was thinking in a limited way. And what released me from that limited thinking was an experience I had with classical piano. So classical piano was something that I had a natural affinity for. Piano and music I had a natural affinity for, but I had an experience where I did not practice well. I got in front of an auditorium full of people and I crashed. I was unable to continue what I was playing. I froze. I had to graciously stand up, bow to the audience, thank them, and leave, which sparked me to get a really great teacher. I got a teacher from the New England Conservatory, and this was a different kind of teacher. You know, we talk about coaching, right? This was a different teacher than I'd ever had. Most piano teachers tell you what to play. They tell you, straighten your shoulders out, hold your hands this way, play loud, play soft, play fast, play slow. This teacher taught me how to learn piano. She taught me primarily, and I think you'll appreciate this as a martial artist. She taught me how to break down difficulty. So in other words, what I learned from the experience of working with this piano teacher was how to take something difficult and complex, break it down into very small working parts, and to learn to revere the practice, not to revere the practice more than the end result.
Right.
And over a, and I learned to take a longer time to learn things, not shorter. So where I might, because of my natural affinity, I might have in the past learned a piece over 2 weeks, I take 4 months, I take 5 months, I take 6 months. But when I was done, it was a polished gem.
Nice.
And with that experience, I intuitively knew how to learn everything else. So I set myself on a different trajectory academically. I decided to apply to graduate school for business. I did well enough on a test called the GMAT to win a full fellowship to study business at Columbia. Both of these results would not have been available to me in high school, but in the way I was in high school. Right. And so I had in my own person tangible evidence that our capabilities are stretchable. So I went to work for large companies and small as a product developer. But the seed of my accidental tutoring company was there because of this growthful experience I had for myself. I'll pause to see if you have any questions about what I've said so far.
No, I'm just loving it. And the fact that you even associate it with martial arts and understanding that something complex is truly just a bunch of little things put together, right? If we think of a building, right, as an architect, as an engineer, as anything that we put something together, we may look at an airplane, but how many parts go into that airplane? Even your car, a bicycle, anything that we sometimes, like, just the fact that we can have a rocket go into space and all we see is a rocket. But if we had to count the parts that make that possible, we'd be counting for a long time, right? So when we break it down to the nitty-gritty, if you will, that's where the true experience is. That's where the true beauty is. And not many people can see that or be overwhelmed, if you will, by that experience. Because once you can understand that experience, then you can appreciate every little thing, right?
Yeah, what you're saying resonates with me greatly, Raphael. I once came across I once came across an author named Thomas Stirner, who wrote a book called The Practicing Mind. And his venue for these kinds of reflections were was golf, music, and craft. He did complex work preparing instruments for the stage. But it occurred to me in reading his book that I'd always had a little bit of a resistance to meditation because meditation symbolized escape. In other words, I thought of it as something that you do, you know, but in a remote place in the Himalayas. But when you look at this breaking down of a complex activity into its working parts, and you learn to revere the practice, it's almost like a moving meditation. In other words, it's a place of peace and stillness when you're actually moving and accomplishing a great deal. And that to me is represents a kind of ideal. So I like others, I do seek peace and tranquility, but I seek it in the context of my activity. And I do seek rest and repose, but I seek it by enjoying the playing of my chosen game. So that kind of reverence for practice has over time enabled me to feel no trade-off between work and play. In other words, if my work happens to engage me in 80 hours a week, and as long as I'm getting enough sleep, so be it. What else would I rather be doing?
Right, exactly.
Am I looking for more TV time? I don't think so.
Yeah. You know, when we can associate the love of doing something, then time kind of like flies by, doesn't it? But time truly slows down when we are not enjoying the activity, right? It's like, oh, is this over yet? Right. Meanwhile, we can realize when we are engulfed in a project or an activity, it's like, where did the time go? Because you're so deep into it. It's almost like the world around you stops for you. Meanwhile, it's going fast. And you're like, wait a minute, how did this happen? You know, I was doing this thing, or I was doing this drawing, and all of a sudden 3 hours passed by. Meanwhile, it feels like if it was 5 minutes because you were so engulfed in it, right?
Yeah, that's a great place to be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's where the meditation comes in.
Yeah, we access it in different ways. I have never been a martial artist. I've always had a profound admiration for it. And from it, from the outside, I see it as I would imagine that a martial artist gets to a similar place that I get to when I break down music in a certain way. It is a particularly joyful feeling when you've broken something down and you've practiced all the little components of it. And then there comes a moment, I call it liftoff. And liftoff is when all of a sudden, all that, and it seems like a sudden, you just notice it, you don't force it,
right?
That it seems that of a sudden, all of that practicing kicks in. And all of a sudden, you're not walking or jogging or trotting anymore. You're flying. And that's, I would say, that's a pretty blissful state.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, and I love the way you put it, because it's that liftoff, right? And it may be all that work that you've been doing, and all of a sudden, boom, there it is, right?
Yeah, all of a sudden.
All of a sudden. Boom.
Yeah, that's a beautiful feeling.
Thing.
Yeah, and I think that I think when it comes to coaching, I think that that it's a good model for many of the, I'm going to use the word loosely, many of the games we play. So I think that it's a preferred way for me. It's a preferred way to approach difficulty of any kind. break it down, work on the components with reverence, work on them when you're working on them as if it's the only thing you ever have to think about. Mm. And then keep working on them, and then enjoy the liftoff when it comes.
Yeah.
And I've had that experience with more complex things in a business setting. And it's wonderful. You know, it's wonderful when you've taken a complex and difficult project and you've broken it down and you've engaged team members, and then and you go through the wear and tear that we experience in all things human. Mm-hmm. But then when you see it really take shape and soar, it's a great experience, and it's an experience that you come back to. And so that brings me to the launch of the coaching, because I know that's part of the Genesis question is an mm-hmm. important question. So I had developed products for large and small companies and took a year and a half off to write and produce my own musical. You can take the boy away from music, but you can't take music out of the boy. So I decided that I want to call it a romance. Music and I are not married, but it's a romance. I return to it from time to time. So I conceived of this musical, writing a musical about the friendship and partnership of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And it was a notably bad idea. At least on the face of it, a bad idea. I was sharing it with my sister, and I told her about the idea for this musical, and she said, "Well, let me get this straight, Steve." She said, "You want to write a musical about two of the Beatles, and you want to produce it, but you're not going to have any Beatles music in it. You're going to have your own music. So you're going you're going to purport to attract people to a musical about the Beatles, but it's not going to have Beatles music." I said, "Yeah." She said, "Seems like a challenge." And I went to work on that challenge. And my intent was to create music that had the spirit of the Beatles. And so I went to work on it, broke it down. We went to work on every aspect of it, hired a cast, hired a hall right on Broadway. And we did all the working parts. Most of the things we were doing were not working very well, except for the musical parts and the theatrical parts were working very well. Our challenge was that we weren't selling many tickets. We had a hall. We'd spent the money for the hall, but we did get liftoff, and it became quite by accident, a woman with very great connections heard a trailer of our musical, got very excited, asked to produce it with us. And she was the type of person who knew everybody. Mm-hmm. And we found ourselves with news coverage, a full house. By the way, my plan was only to do this musical for one night. It was a special event. And we sold it out. I took a week off after the musical took place to, I took a week off to just
to exalt. Be.
Yeah, I actually was living in New York City at the time. I took a park bench along the FDR Drive along the East River, and I just sat looking out at the river for a whole week. And then I decided, well, I think I've got the space in my life to try something different. I didn't know what it was going to be, but a friend of mine who was a college advisor for a private school on Long Island said, "You know, gee, I wish you were available to help some of our kids," because he knew I had some interesting academic things in my background. Because I didn't think he was serious, I said, "Sure, no problem." And some months later, he started sending me students. It was one of life's surprises, Raphael, because it was not something I'd ever planned of or thought of, but it did connect to my early experience of elevating my own game and having an understanding of how to do it. So when I first started seeing students, I said, "Sure, this is congruent." And I had such a great enjoyment of it that my accidental tutoring company was born. I worked with one family who referred to others, and coaching practices take time, but within a pretty reasonable amount of time, I had a full practice and wound up in a modest way hiring a few coaches to work with me. The reason for it was, I would say in a modest way, is that I always had the intention of eventually turning what we did into a product. In other words, having the business training that I did, I decided I love the coaching. And at the same time, I know I'm going to reach the point where I want to apply the wisdom of the coaching in such a way that it can reach and be available to more students. So about 3 years ago, we began, my son and partner, Tom, began developing learning games based on our coaching wisdom. The games embody the way we teach. So that's there's our full story. I've been doing the coaching for almost two decades now, and it's been just a wonderful experience. I could probably take the rest of our time together to tell you how joyful it is and was, and it. I'll only add one more thing. It's been so joyful that I would say to you that it puts me in a great position. I believe we're here to serve. And yeah. I believe that quantity is important, but it's not everything. So I can have a certain freedom about what I create henceforth. Because there's a question of how high it's up. How high it's up. In other words, once you've experienced the joy of helping one person fulfill her potential, then the difference between one and 1,000 and 1,000,000 is only a matter of quantity. It's not a matter of the level of joy. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Let me ask you a question. So earlier you spoke about Mozart.
Yep.
And we're talking about a child prodigy, right? So and we've noticed in the world a bunch of child prodigies, and it doesn't necessarily have to only be music. It's in other academics and so forth. Do you believe that some child prodigies are not found until later on, until maybe they're in their late teens or even into a young adulthood?
So not found because they're just simply not noticed, and they're discovered later, or they're not noticed ever. We don't even ever get to see.
We both, because sometimes even they haven't found themselves. They haven't touched upon that one thing that made them a prodigy. Had they been exposed to it earlier on? So whether they've been exposed to it, if they were exposed to it earlier on, then of course they would have been that child prodigy. But maybe they never encountered it until a later age, or no one ever heard of them until a certain time.
Yeah, I do believe that happens. I do believe, sadly, that some prodigies never get to express their gift.
Mm-hmm.
They never discover it. I also believe that some people never connect with what they care at because they spend their whole lives pursuing something that they think they should do.
Right.
And that happens. And I would say that's one of life's more tangled issues because there is a feeling of risk that people experience in pursuing their true calling, particularly if there's not a clearly laid out path. And I can tell you, as one who has survived the risk, I'm glad I took it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'd recommend it to everyone.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like, although I would say, if we think about life in terms of colors, when you're doing something because you think it's the thing you ought to be doing, then your life is kind of gray.
Mm.
It's not, I mean, gray, I don't get me wrong. I like gray when I'm
gray's a nice color.
Nice color, but it's not bright. You know, it's sort of like the gray is not colorful. Whereas when you are pursuing something that your heart tells you to do, life really comes alive. And even with some of the ups and downs that come with not following a prescribed path, a path where you have to chart things for yourself.
Right, right. You know, the reason I ask that is because I'm thinking of all the people who truly come into doing something, and it's amazing, but they do it once they realize that they're not happy in their career or their life choices. And all of a sudden, like I remember, I think her name was Grandma Moses. She started painting at 70 something. And her artwork was like amazing. Meanwhile, she had never picked up a brush prior to that. And it was just some inspiration that said, you know, pick up a brush. And people were like, wow, who drew this? And then, well, who painted this? And it was this woman who had, you know, a life already. And it's like she was reborn through her artwork.
I love that. I love that kind of story. I think that I think there are a few things that come up, you know, because of my early heroes and what I've learned subsequently. I've developed a few thoughts about talent and how to advise my students, if you will, about how they might think about it. I do believe that talent exists.
Right.
However, I don't believe we know for sure what it is. So, for example, I have had enough experience of people developing greatness seemingly out of whole cloth. I have a friend, for instance, who by some accident was told by an English teacher in 11th grade, this is almost like a Grandma Moses story. He was told by an English teacher in 11th grade that he really ought to write. And it was an epiphany for this young friend of mine. And up to that point, I don't see how his writing ability could have been manifest because he didn't read much and he didn't have much vocabulary to that point. I don't know what the teacher saw and why, just like I don't know why that college advisor on Long Island saw that I ought to be coaching students and why, but there was an intuition there. But my friend is a very persistent fellow, and over the years found himself publishing poetry books and writing children's books. And he's been a notable writer who's traveled the world. And so the thing about it's a subtle topic, because if the talent shows up a little later, so be it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to create it, if you're determined enough, I believe you can.
Right.
And I love the stories about Grandma Moses, because I think it's one of the great, I think it's one of the great gifts of neuroscience that I think people are only just beginning to fathom. I think when I looked at neuroscience, I oversimplify things for a point, for a purpose, but the heart of learning involves aggregations of nerve cells in the brain, where the nerve cells come together to help perform a learning task. And the more you practice something, the brain supplies more nerve cells and provides a mechanism for the nerve cells to communicate more rapidly and more efficiently.
Right.
So what happens is that in effect, your brain develops a mechanism to support.
Do you have to answer that?
I don't plan to, and it's not ringing in a minute. Sorry.
No problem. So
I should have thought that in advance.
Well, you know, it was somebody who's telling you that what you're saying makes sense.
There it goes. And so, but here's the thing. If we look at that, then it looks like the notion, you know, I do understand about how rapidly the brain develops in the years, say, you know, 1 to 3, and those are important. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that if we keep learning, then there is no upper limit to how great we can be. And there is no preset age for us to stop learning. So your Grandma Moses example is a very apt one. What about a story I recently read about a gentleman who, I don't remember his name, but he just earned his PhD in physics from Brown University at the age of 89. Mm. So the reason that neuroscience is so important is when you look at most people actually are living their lives, and this may sound harsh, but most people are living most of their lives in decline. Yes. They've been taught to believe that they reach their physical and mental peak at age 25 and that the hardware gradually declines. You know, and when in fact, if one keeps building those neural networks by learning and by joyful practice, I believe the science is backing me up more and more on this. I believe we can keep getting better. You may have a better experience with me as to how long and how well a martial artist can develop. But as far as I'm concerned, for painting or for physics or for math, I think we can keep getting better. And so I think that's the real gift of neuroscience. And so that's why I so appreciate your story about Grandma Moses.
Well, you know, Steve, I got to tell you, for me, sometimes I say, man, I wish when I was in my 20s, I had the brain I have today.
Right.
Right? Because where would I be today if I thought and I use my brain the way I use it today, if I did it back then? Holy cow. What would I have been able to accomplish? I mean, don't get me wrong. I've accomplished a lot with my life, but is it that growth that we needed to go through? Because I think the maturity level also helps us to decipher life a little bit more than we did when we were younger, right? Because as a teenager, you and I, and probably every teenager, we know everything, right? We know everything, and we don't listen to those people who've already been living a life, who are already in their 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and older. And we don't take those lessons to heart. But I guess it's almost like having to make the mistakes in order to learn from them, right?
Yeah, I think the if you look at what you're doing today, I would bet you find that you're using it all. Mm. I feel like I'm using it all. I'm using the good experiences. I'm using the bad experiences. And so I feel that, you know, because I have a reverence for the process, I feel very grateful for, I feel very grateful for the game that we're in. I mean, the game that you and I are both in. I think that it's great to take something on and to keep getting. I do enjoy getting better at it. I know that some people say that getting better is a notion of ego, but I think it's really a reverence for what you do. I think it's working I look at it as a almost like the metaphor of the farmer. In other words, you live in the pleasant in the present moment, but you're planting seeds, right. and so in effect, you're simultaneously taking care of your present and your future. But getting back to that issue of younger versus more advanced, I think that this is a real emerging gift. I think the more the precepts of neuroscience filter into the popular culture, I think it will help more people escape from the assumption of decline. Mm. In other words, if you're in high school and your high school coach tells you, enjoy this because this is the best experience you're ever going to have, or you're at a Wall Street firm and you're 30 and you're subtly told that, you know, this is you got up and comers who are 22 who are going to be better than you and nudge you out. I think so many people, because of the way we think about advancing, they're thinking about it inaccurately, and so they're in effect in a culturally induced state of decline that they don't need. Mm. In other words, have you heard a person forget something and say it's a senior moment? I mean, sometimes a person shockingly young, 40 years old, refers to something as a senior moment. And when we think about that, the folly of that, what I don't remember who explained it to me this way, but it's a brilliant explanation. If you've got somebody who is working in a static, oh, I know where it comes from. It comes from Joe Dispenza, who wrote a book called Evolve Your Brain. Right. If you've been working in a job that calls upon nothing new from you and you're working at that job for decades, is it any wonder that you're not getting smarter? Is it any wonder that the neural networks start to weaken and decline? Let's take it a little further. Let's say you've retired, and now let's say you've been retired for 20 years and you haven't really challenged yourself for 20 years. Any wonder that those neural networks
shutting down,
are starting to weaken, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you're that guy who's just earned his PhD at age 89 from Brown in physics. I would bet you he's smarter than he's ever been. And I would bet you that if the universe gives him another 15, 20 years, I bet you he'll be smarter at the end than he is at the beginning. Right. And I think it's a much more creative and great way to look at our capabilities than the way we've historically looked at them.
Yeah. So how do we change when somebody says a senior moment when it means forgetful, and we change it to be a senior moment, brilliant?
Yeah, that's a great. Yeah, it's like anything else. You start to adopt different language for it. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be new, because I think the assumption of decline is almost pervasive.
Right.
I think the science comes out, the more it will weaken that assumption of decline. So you're right. Senior moment, brilliant. And rather than thinking about someone of an advanced age as being this kind of gentle elder person who can offer wisdom, you know, spiritual guidance to the young up and comer. What if that person is actually more adept because that person has used the software as well? I'm talking about the software as well as he has for 40, 50 or 60 years. I think that will be a new paradigm. And in so many ways, as we advance as a species, we learn to let go of past concepts of scarcity and embrace new concepts of abundance. And I think that our coming generations will learn to have this greater sense of abundance in the human lifespan, mm-hmm. and not just the number of years, but the quality of it. Right. I don't think we need to decline at all.
Right. Agreed.
That's a extreme Agreed. Position, but that's my. I'll stake it here.
But you know, you're absolutely right. For someone who does not continue to grow, so those neurons are not expanding. They're not, and like you said it before, that they're slowing down, but I say they're dying because there's no new growth. You don't farm a land once. You farm it every season. You farm it all season, not just one time when you plant it. You have to take care of it, right? You have to water it. You have to fertilize it. You have to go on and on and on. And then once you take the crops out, you have to set it again in order to plant again. You can't just plant on dirt that hasn't been taken care of. So you have to take care of the dirt so that you can have crops again. So a good farmer understands these things. And I think a person who retires and does nothing with their life, I believe also that's why a lot of people die. They have no more purpose, right? So to me, when somebody says to me, when are you retiring? I'm like, never. Because when I retire, that means I'm done. I will never be done. I will continue to grow. And so for me, it's always how much more could I learn? Every day is an opportunity for growth. Every single day. And on the day, I can't recall the day I haven't learned something. And from every person I speak with, I'm looking to learn. So thank you for teaching me today. I appreciate you. But well, here's the thing, right? We need to do that. We need to have that growth mindset every day, not just when it's convenient. It should be a habit, if you will.
I totally agree. And thank you for the conversation. I find that I'm learning as I'm learning from this conversation as well. Mm. Let me throw in one more beautiful thought here.
Sure.
And that is go back to first youth, right? Go back to when you were 18 or 19 and now think about a second youth or even a third youth. The beauty of continuing to learn and grow indefinitely is you get to not only do you get to do some of the great things that you might have been doing in your first youth, but it's you appreciate them much more. Right. So in other words, it's sort of like the joy is much greater. I don't know what it is about the, at least my 18-year-old brain was kind of firmly fixed in past and future, and not able to appreciate anything. Mm. And so to be able to have a great life and appreciate it is just, I don't know. It's just a great, great thing. And I think that may be the big difference.
Yeah. You know, Steve, when I was young, I used to look at older men and I used to go, man, one day I'm going to be like that. One day I'm going to be like that. And then I still haven't gotten there because I have that young mind. I'm like, one day. And so when somebody says to me, sir, I'm like, what? Who are you talking to me? I'm the kid. Yeah. I'm the kid in this conversation. So, but for me, like I call everybody a kid, and I'll call people who are older than me, hey, kids, come over here. And they're like, why are you calling me a kid? I said, because I want you to be youthful. I want you to enjoy what we're about to do. And it doesn't matter the age. And a lot of people, and I've heard a lot of people in their 40s, 30s even say, I'm too old. I'm like, you're not old. I said, but you are. If you believe it, you are. You're old. I said, well, how old do you feel? Oh, I feel like I'm 60, 70. I said, but you're only like 38. I'm like, why are you feeling that way? Oh, I'm run down. I work too much. I do this. I said, so why are you doing all that? Well, I have to provide for my family. I said, yeah, you can provide for your family. But what if you enjoyed the process? What would that do for you? I never thought of it that way. I said, well, time to start thinking, right? Use that brain of yours to stay young. To be a beautiful soul, I think we have to enjoy life in the moment. A lot of people are living either in the past or in the future. They're thinking, oh, because if you're 30 and you're saying you're old, are you living? Are you thinking you're 60? Some people even look way older than they are. When they're 40, they look 65. And I'm like, wow. And when people find out how old I am, they're like, you're that young? I'm like, yeah. Yeah. And it's that concept of how we see ourselves, how we see ourselves in the world, how we see our thinking, and even what we think about. Just the same way as how do you eat? You know, what do you put into your body is going to reflect on the outcome of your body. And also what you put into your mind is going to be a reflection of even how you think. I want to ask you a couple of questions based on games.
Yep. Right?
Because that, I know that's a topic we need to talk about.
Great.
So you talked about your coaching and how you started helping young people, because someone saw in you a coach, a leader, someone who can help other people. And at first you didn't believe him, right? You were like, why is he asking me? And then you realize, oh, maybe I could do this. And yeah. Then that, as you call it, accidental tutoring started happening. But was it accidental, or was it accidental only for you, but for someone else that already saw where your capabilities were?
I think that's a great question, and I'll share with you a belief. Mm. And when I coach people, I don't require them. We don't have to have the same set of beliefs when I coach somebody. Right. The only thing when I coach somebody, I want to persuade them that the limitations they think they have, they don't have. I think that's at the heart of the coaching process, is to help someone lose both the attitude and the feeling sense of limitation that they've been carrying around. Mm. But in terms of, for me, I do believe that we're not quite alone. I don't presume to define for other people what divine intelligence looks like. But if I look at my life plan, given the fact that I never could or would have planned for this chapter of my life, in other words, I never had any desire to be a teacher in the classroom. So I think it was the universe's way of nudging me to say, okay, Steve, here is an aspect of yourself that will bring you great joy if you'll grab onto this and develop it. Mm. And sure enough, it's been all of that. Mm. It's just opened up many aspects of my own being, and I would say expanded joy in ways I can't describe. So my answer to your question is accidental for me, but perhaps perhaps part of a higher plan that I didn't see.
Yeah, I love it. And you know, when we realize that we do have a calling, we do have a purpose, right? And you know, sometimes there's a calling, but we're doing this. We're covering our ears. We're not hearing it, right? And so many people are so gifted. That's why I asked you earlier about prodigies and going into Grandma Moses. We didn't realize the potential that we have until someone else maybe sees it in us. Maybe someone else is the person that handed her the brush and said, hey, do this. Make it a hobby. You're not doing anything else. You might as well do it. And the beauty that came out of that brush was not the brush. It was her, right? Mm-hmm. And the beauty that comes out when you coach somebody, it's not the coaching. It is you. So when we think about our purpose, our higher calling from, I'm going to say it right out, from God, right? That's because I believe in God. We all are beautiful human beings, but we have to learn to accept that in each other and to help as many people as we can. I think that's our calling for all of us in one way or another. Everybody has a purpose. The dentist has a purpose. The mechanic has a purpose. A school teacher has a purpose. An engineer has a purpose. Architect, every single person has a purpose. And sometimes they're not living the purpose they were meant to live. They're living the purpose of their parents or their loved ones. They're not following the pursuit of their happiness as well.
I think I agree with you so strongly. And I think that the proof of it, the proof of what you're saying is in the joy. Mm. I've had few joys as great as the joy of helping someone else and helping that person liberate herself from past limitations. That is such a joy. I can tell you that it is a true joy to create and perform a musical composition. That's a mm-hmm. true joy. I would say that this joy of being of true service to someone else is even greater for me.
Yes.
And so I think that I agree with you that it is our calling. And I think the proof of it is how much joy there is in it. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing. And I think most coaches who are coaching for the right reason will probably share a similar experience. It's something mm-hmm. that we are really, it's a privilege to be able to do.
Right. Absolutely. So you grew up in Long Island. What part of Long Island did you grow up in?
Oh, that's right. You're familiar with Long Island too.
I'm in Farmingdale, Long Island.
So I grew up in Wantagh.
Oh, okay. Not far from me.
First Levittown.
Okay.
In Wantagh.
Gotcha.
And Wantagh was, about a 5-block journey from Levittown. But, mm-hmm. But yeah, South Shore and, right. Yeah.
Where are you in the world now?
Well, I came to the North Shore of Long Island by way of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. I moved to Manhattan as a young adult and lived there, and then moved out to Port Washington a few years ago for two reasons. One was for to support my accidental tutoring company, and the other was for love. I met my
love of your life
out here in Long Island, and we've settled here together.
Beautiful. So being that you're out here in Long Island and I have a bunch of other coaches out here, I'm looking to get a little get together of a bunch of us, and we'd love for you to join us. So I'll definitely keep sharing with you, and let's stay connected that way so that all of us can get together and have all these amazing coaches just pour into each other, right? And we'll break some bread and have some fun that way.
Love
so
it.
Let's get into the games. You partner with your son, and you said one of the things you talked about games. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm using the word game a bit differently than it's typically used. There's a lot of talk about gamification and making the making academic subjects more engaging. That's part of it, but that's actually a small part of it. The game for me is at the heart of all learning. So in other words, when I tied together the discoveries I made about learning classical piano, and I related it conceptually to what I imagine might be the process in martial arts or golf. Essentially, in our coaching model, we teach students to approach difficult learning challenges as they would any game of skill. And so that's at the heart of the game. And so a game has a certain sequence that that can be followed for mastery. And so I'm going to share with you, if you will, sure. I'm going to share with you what the sequence is. So before you, I find that I call it getting the whole story up front. I told you about my piano teacher told me about how to learn piano. I found that aspect was important, that I could go into the learning process not simply being told what to do, but being told globally what learning piano was about. So I find that's a preset for learning the game. Another preset for learning the game is getting someone good to show you how to play. I don't believe it's necessary to figure things out for yourself, and probably a bad idea, because you can actually bake in some bad habits in terms of practice routines. So with those presets, then there are four steps to learning a game. First, we learn the moves of the game. So every game has its fundamentals. There are fewer or lesser of them in each game, but for an example, in golf, it's the grip, the stance, the long drive, the fairway iron, the pitch, the putt,
the swing,
right? There are certain moves that you learn, and in most games, what you do is you get someone to show you the moves and you practice them to the point of where they become non-conscious habit. That's a necessary precondition to learning a game. So first you learn the moves, then you practice the moves in combination. So so for example, in tennis, once I've mastered the forehand, backhand, stance, grip, net play, and all of those, I might rally with my coach. So that's practicing the moves in combination. And there are metaphors for this with all the academic work we do. So in other words, if you break down an academic discipline into problem types, learning the moves in combination is where you do mixed practice, where you're now still conscious, but you're identifying a challenge and saying, okay, this is the problem type and this is how I solve it. Mm-hmm. And then the third step is you play the game a lot. And it's iterative. There's never a terminal point. It's you keep circling around, relearn the moves, practice the moves in combination, and playing the game a lot. So I found in our coaching practice, this was a very liberating thing. So the kid who's never been good at math, I wound up having a conversation with a kid who was not only never good in math, but had certain neurological challenges that made math extremely difficult for him. But I said to him, Jonah, because I knew he was a very avid athlete. He would practice his foul shot all day, or he would practice his tennis swing all day. I said, what do you suppose would happen, Jonah, if you practiced math problems with the same intensity that you practiced your foul shot and your jump shot? And Jonah said to me, Steve, I would be a math monster. And and that concept became very liberating for him, because he learned to approach an academic game with the same joy and intensity that he approached academic games. And it liberated him. It enabled him to achieve for the first time in his life academically. So that's the heart of the game. So our learning games, our digital learning games, capture that process. So our learning games have that break down any academic challenge into that process and make it conscious for the person, so the learner knows what they're doing, and also weaves in concepts that help the learner let go of limitation. We have we teach 10 thinking habits, 10 feeling habits, and 10 learning habits that we find liberate the learner to play their best game. And
I love it.
That's part of, so we currently we now have 3 games. We have a standardized test game here in the United States. We have a standardized test game in the United Kingdom, and what we're calling an academic accelerator game for the student who is coming into a new grade and needs to get up to speed. So we have 3 games, but we see ourselves building a library of games, so that every subject that people find dull or difficult can be framed as a game of skill. And what we see then is being able to make, being able to teach a person how to be a high-powered learner. In other words, independent of the game. If you understand that we're learning beings, and we can be comfortable learning things we're good at, and be comfortable learning things we're not as good at, I feel that's an advantageous place to be. So that's our intent with the games.
I love it. And so when we can think about, and you said about an athlete, right? They're really good at practicing their foul shot or whatever. And then you can say, well, why don't we take the same energy and put it into that subject that you stink at, right? Or that gives you so much trouble. What if you even put a third of that energy, or tiny, you know, a quarter of that energy into that? It does change the perspective, doesn't it?
In a big way, in a big way. And it's extremely liberating. I want to share 2 thoughts about it. I know that for the most part, and I've hired many coaches over the course of my learning. So I'm aware that it's important to build on strengths and not spend a life chasing weaknesses. Mm-hmm. However, I think that it really is also important to be able to confront something that we've not thought ourselves as being good at. So for example, supposing you're not good at approaching strangers in a room for the first time, and you've never been good at that, I think it's wonderfully liberating to be able to do it after all. So the way I share it with my students is, I don't want to encourage you to spend your whole life chasing your weaknesses and working on your weaknesses. I also want you to be fearless about mastering something you've thought of as a weakness if it suits you. Mm-hmm. And so how can it suit us? One example is a fairly modest one. Suppose my wife convinces me to take a ballroom dancing course or a salsa dancing course. I don't see myself as someone who's physically graceful, so this would be a bit outside my comfort zone, but I do it with joy because I know all about learning. And I know that as awkward as I might begin, I'm going to be able to make something of the class. So being able to come into things with beginner's mind and approach it as a learner is powerful. But then there's also things in our business lives, we approach the abyss, or we approach a chasm. Okay, we are going to have to leap over that chasm. We have not been here before. So we are going to have to, at this moment in our lives, be good at something we've never been good at before. And that's where experiencing yourself as a lifelong learner is your backup. You know, I've been here before. I've learned things that I was scared of before. I've learned things that, as you put it, I stink at. I've mastered them before. It's good. It builds your confidence. For Jonah, being able to handle math, being able to handle a standardized test when it was the hardest possible thing for him, and being able to handle it and not only come through it, but come through it with flying colors, is a liberating experience. He's got a reservoir in his memory. He knows that he's got that latency in him that he can confront his adversary and he can overcome.
Yeah. And once they learn that lesson, then they can use it for everything, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I love the fact that you brought up a beginner's mind, because a lot of instructors don't teach with that. And so when I teach instructors, when I teach someone who's going to teach someone else, I ask them to teach it to me first. And I really make believe I don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it frustrates them. And I say, well, you're teaching it to me as and you're assuming that I know what you're talking about. So I'm going to make believe I don't know what you're talking about. So you really have to teach it to me as if you were a beginner yourself. And they're like, that is so difficult. I said, well, how do you think they feel if they don't understand it? Because you're teaching it to them as if they should know it. That's where the mistake happens, I think, for a lot of instructors who are learning to teach. The first thing that we have to do is be that student ourselves. So one of the mottos that I always go by is that, yes, I may be a black belt, but I am a white belt that never quit. Right.
Oh, yeah.
That's it for sure.
I think that's wonderful. And I am, as a side note, I am really looking forward to, in a separate conversation, really digging into this martial arts experience with you. I'm really looking forward to learning about that.
Sure. Absolutely. You know, I'd love to, and I have it coming across the screen. We have Heroes Rising Apex happening July 13th through the 16th, where I'm bringing coaches from all over the world. I got people from Singapore, from Argentina, from South Africa, from Australia, people coming from all over, and here in the U.S. as well. And we're getting together to have a Heroes Rising Apex. And when we think about the apex, we're taking everybody to the summit. And we'd love for you to be part of it. And anybody listening, we'd love for everybody to come and join us and meet amazing coaches and amazing authors and just amazing people. So we definitely, Steve, would love to have you there with us.
Lovely. Lovely.
Yeah. So before we go, what advice would you give somebody who is looking to either be a coach or hire a coach like yourself?
Great. So let's start with be a coach. Sure. I think that a few thoughts. The heart of it is choose your client. Mm. I think that giving real care to whom you want to serve is a big thing. That I right. think that the happiest aspect of my private coaching practice is, I want to call it, the evolution of my clientele. That over over time, having given more thought and care for whom I was serving, I was able to make the practice more and more joyful, and more joyful translates into more successful. So I think give great thought to whom your client is, endeavor to serve that client better than their expectations are. Love them, bring a reverence to what you do and to how you serve. Learn everything you need to learn and give it time. I can recall early in my accidental company thinking about, oh, gee, I know I'm doing this really well. Why don't I have more clients? I can say that question went away, but it's like anything else. It's analogous to practicing the piano piece or preparing for a martial arts competition. You kind of work at something and work at something and work at something, and then you get liftoff. It's important not to get discouraged if the liftoff doesn't occur immediately. So, and going back to the farmer's model, I think it was Jack Canfield who once said, the mistake people make is that they plant the seeds and then they go every day into their garden to see that the seeds have sprouted, and they make themselves quite tense and agitated in the process. And sometimes they even in frustration dig up the soil and say, this is not working. Right. And so plant the seeds, water them, nurture them with reverence, and let your practice grow in its season. Mm-hmm. Would be the fundamental philosophical approach. And to hire a coach, listen to their story. And if the story resonates with you, then you're kind of, you're establishing a good starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. Love it. Steve, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your expertise with us today. And you'll appreciate you being here with us today. When we think about, and I love your website, MuchSmarter.com, because every day I believe you can be much smarter.
Thank you for that, Raphael, and thank you for having me. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Likewise. So let's stay in touch. We're probably going to get together sometime soon, and a bunch of us are just going to get together. We're going to share some knowledge, and we're going to do it out here in Long Island. So hey, you never know. Maybe some of our listeners may want to come. So thank you, my friend. Have an amazing and beautiful rest of your day. We'll talk soon.
Talk soon.